Today on the Florida Roundup, this week the Miami-Dade Attorney General's Office handed down the decision 12 Miami Beach police officers were legally justified when they shot and killed Raymond Harris, a 22-year-old African-American man who reportedly was running from officers. We'll take a look into the policy changes within the agency. A Broward County public school teacher was suspended for racist remarks toward one of her students. The parents of the child think the punishment didn't go far enough, and they're even going to the FBI. Then we go to Tallahassee for a review of a measure that made it through its second hurdle in the Capitol. And this week is Government in the Sunshine Week. How open is our government? Join me, Luis Hernandez, and WLRN's Gina Jordan next on the Florida Roundup.
Hello and welcome. I'm Luis Hernandez. And I am joined by Gina Jordan. Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Well, prosecutors announced this week that they will not charge police involved in the Memorial Day shooting on Miami Beach 4 years ago. Police fired 116 shots at Raymond Harris, killing him in his car. Police had tried to stop Harris from driving recklessly up and down Collins Avenue. Prosecutors said police were justified in using deadly force on Harris because he was putting other lives in danger. Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine, who was not in office at the time of the shooting, said the city's police department is very different today.
And the fact that we have a new chief and a new deputy chief shows that Miami Beach is poised to move into the next century with a very great, positive culture and vision that includes respect for everybody.
On today's program, we're going to look at the decision and the community's response. And it is your show, too. Do you think police were justified in using deadly force? Tell us. Call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN. Joining me now in the studio from the Miami Herald is David Ovalle. David, welcome.
Thank you. How are you?
You know what? I wanted to start by just going after this decision. It came down Tuesday night. And since then, there really hasn't been a lot of discussion or noise. Nothing like what we saw after what happened in Ferguson, Missouri. What sort of conversations or emotions do you hear in the community right now?
Well, I think what happened in Ferguson the last couple months is something that really roiled Miami, but, 20, 25 years ago during after controversial police shootings when there were riots and there was a lot of upheaval. I think the process has grown up a bit. I think people realize that, these cases are not easy. They don't happen in a vacuum. And I think, certainly there's controversy and there's always going to be controversial police actions. It's just sort of the nature of a tough business. But I think there was a thorough explanation that was done. It was an 87 page memo that really sort of explained what happened that night, and I think it also it also shows how the laws are crafted in Florida.
Do you get the sense, though, because we even had protests here in South Florida on the Ferguson case, but we haven't seen anything on this one? Is it a different type of case?
Yeah, I think it is different. It is definitely different. All the time, whenever you have cases that involve moving cars, it's sort of a different dynamic. And this was a very unique case. And I think part of this controversy that erupted initially after the shooting was it was captured on video. There was real sort of a real visceral type of image that emerged on the internet and on TV. But it was a completely different dynamic. It was a really unique situation because there were so many police officers on a very, very crowded street. And so there was, I think, some sense that, hey, maybe this was a danger to the people on the streets. But, it's a very, very nuanced case, I should say.
Let's go back to the story real quickly. Let's go back to what happened 4 years ago in South Beach. It was happening during Urban Beach Week. The shooting started with an officer trying to get Raymond Harris to shut off his car, to get out of his car. And then what happened?
Well, what happened was the officer, who was a Hialeah police officer, saw Mr. Harris in his car sort of accelerating and then stopping and then accelerating and stopping. And with so many people crowded in the street, the officer said he had fears for the safety of the pedestrians. So he tried to pull him over, opened the door. The guy kind of pushed him and sort of veered the car left. knocking over the officer. In that instance, Mr. Harris ended up driving, speeding away, almost hitting several cars, at least four or five cars, as well as nearly running over some police officers.
And didn't the report say, too, that he was off on the sidewalk and it was all over the place?
Yes, yes. He was on the sidewalk. He was in the opposite direction of traffic. So many of the officers made the decision to start firing despite there being so many people on the streets.
Now, this is before he stopped, because he eventually ended up in front of the Royal Palm Hotel, and this is what we see in the video. So the car is stopped near this intersection, and then officers surround the car, get in front of the car, I believe. What happened before that wave of fire?
Well, there was actually three separate shooting scenes. There was the first one where he stopped briefly and police officers started firing at him. Then a second time, about a block later, where he sort of stopped and several officers started shooting at him. And then the third scene was the final scene where he stopped, and it's unclear what he was doing inside the car, but there was about 62 seconds where the officers surround him, and you can see it on the video, and they're yelling at him to get out, show us your hands, show us your hands. And although none of the officers gave statements, the civilian witnesses heard a police officer say, you know, he's got a gun, or he appeared to be reaching downward. Unclear as to what was happening, but, you know, they felt there was a threat and they fired.
So the Miami-Dade State Attorney's Office ruled that the action was legally justified. Did that report say anything about the fact that there were that many shots taken at the car?
No. And they do allude to a few. They allude to it in a sense when they say, you know, it may not have been the safest option, or they had sort of this Hobson's choice about whether they should let him possibly hit a pedestrian or run over an officer, or whether they should try to use deadly force. I think ultimately that can't be a consideration for a criminal charge, but it can be definitely in the civil arena. And I think ultimately the amount of shots fired will end up being a real issue in the civil case.
Again, we're talking about the decision that came down earlier this week, Miami-Dade State Attorney's Office ruling that the shooting 4 years ago in South Beach legally justified when officers shot 116 times into the car, killing Mr. Harris in the car. We've been talking with David Ovalle of the Miami Herald. I want to bring in now investigative reporter for the Herald, Julie Brown. Julie, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Julie, we heard in this report, what we understand is the officers were justified because this was a fleeing felon. Please help us understand, what is a fleeing felon? How is that explained legally?
Well, they had reason to believe that Raymond Harris was a danger to himself or others, that he, in fact, was committing a felony by trying to run over these police officers, and possibly by harming other people in the course of what he was doing not stopping as they commanded him to do so.
Does that mean that an officer is allowed to use lethal force if they consider someone a fleeing felon?
Well, I guess you got to define your definition of fleeing. I mean, some police departments now will not let you fire into a car, each department has revised sort of their idea of it. But in general, yes, I don't think that prosecutors will criminally charge officers for trying to stop a felon who is fleeing from them.
Why did it take 4 years for this decision to come down? And David, you could jump in as well.
Well, I think that's the big question that everybody's been asking all this time. Although, as David knows, there were an awful lot of people to interview. This was a huge crime scene. As David mentioned, there were three separate shooting scenes. There were a lot of different witness statements to take. I mean, in their defense, it was a very big investigation involving a lot of different pieces. But I do think that there were people that raised questions about why it really did take an awful long time.
David, do you have a take on that?
Yeah, I think there was a lot of ballistics work that had to be done. They actually, and if you read the report, it's actually pretty thorough, and they do it very uniquely in Miami-Dade. They'll take a long time for sure, and there's definitely been a lot of criticism about the amount of time the state attorney's office takes to close out these police shootings or to at least explain what happened. But they do a really thorough look and presentation. They don't, in other jurisdictions, for example, they'll just go to the grand jury. The grand jury will come back, you know, no charges, and there's no ever explanation about why. In this case, I mean, they actually went and looked at all the different bullets and tried to link them to the individual guns from the different officers. So, you know, definitely it's a long time, and there's, you know, there's probably some valid criticism in the amount of time that it takes. But, you know, I think ultimately the Heresy family said they wanted explanation, they wanted answers, and they seem to be mollified that, you know, at least they got some sort of resolution.
And the victims, if I can jump in, the other bystanders that were shot, who, by the way, suffered, you know, one of them cannot walk the way that he will ever probably walk again. There's another one who still has a bullet lodged in his chest. You know, they deserve to know exactly what happened as well.
And we're going to talk about lawsuits here in just a moment. But Julie, you know, in the time since the shooting, there have been policy changes made within the Miami Beach Police Department. What are some of those changes? And not just with policy, but has there been any change in the culture?
Well, I think that's, I mean, if you look at our front page today, we had a story about another police officer getting in trouble in Miami Beach. I think that there is, continues to be a culture, not just in Miami Beach, in all fairness, but across the country, of problematic police officers. I think Miami Beach, because they've been in the spotlight a lot, and, you know, in the national spotlight a lot, has made some changes in the way, some productive changes in the way that it handles certain arrests. And you know, I also wanted to add, as far as the length of this investigation, you know, the Ferguson case and the Michael Brown case in New York, also, you have to understand, with all the intense scrutiny by the public and the media, I think that these prosecutors are also under pressure, and police departments are under pressure, to be very thorough with their investigations.
I did want to bring up, too, Julie, you had looked at this case a couple of years ago, at some of the evidence that police was providing, or information they were providing, and the fact that there was a lot missing. Witness testimony, video that was gathered from different sources. But I'm wondering, what was the most, maybe perhaps, damning thing toward the department's report that they were presenting to the public?
Oh, I have to really think about it. There was a lot of different things. I think that the most problematic thing was that the family, Mr. Heresy's family, and the victims were, I think really the main problem was that especially the bystanders felt that they were being treated as if they were the criminals. They were taken to the hospital after this happened. The bullets were taken out of them. They were questioned in ways that made them feel like they had done something wrong. And that really is I think, what upset a lot of people, that just the whole way it was handled from the get-go was as if these bystanders, from being there, they somehow committed some kind of offense.
David?
There's also, I think, a sense of the tone of the police department at the time was not appropriate. For example, when they announced a couple of days later that they had indeed found a gun inside the car, you know, the Miami Beach police chief at the time made a comment to the effect of, "This is good news. You know, this is progressing as we believed it would." So, you know, ultimately, of course, we find out that the gun was never fired, and there was no evidence that he was actually firing. So, I think there was a little bit of a tone problem.
I do want to ask before we finish up here on the lawsuits. So we have the family of Harris's family. I believe a pending lawsuit, other lawsuits as well. Julie, how many lawsuits are we talking about? Where are they now after this decision?
Well, I think that the lawyers are going to look at what just came down from the prosecutor's office. They have a lot of stuff, ground to cover. They've been waiting a long time for this to be finished, and they're going to have to look at all of this very carefully. I mean, I think that there were at least 4 bystanders, as my recollection, and I'm sure that there's, if not pending litigation that's already been filed. But part of it is they were waiting to see from ballistics and from what the prosecutor found out exactly what all the evidence was.
Julie Brown is an investigative reporter for the Miami Herald. David Ovalle, also with the Miami Herald, covering this story. Again, the decision that came down earlier this week that the attorney's office was not going to file any charges against the officers in the shooting of Raymond Harise. Again, you can share your thoughts. Go to Twitter. We're at WLRN. David, Julie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, coming up next, we're going to be talking about a teacher in Broward County getting in trouble for making racist remarks. I'm Luis Hernandez. This is the Florida Roundup. I'm Luis Hernandez, along with Gina Jordan. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. A Broward school teacher was suspended after she was accused of calling a Muslim student a, quote, raghead Taliban in a classroom. Maria Valdez teaches French at Cypress Bay High School. She directed the comment at 14-year-old Diab Hussein Wardani, who walked into class wearing a hoodie. The Broward School Board voted on Tuesday to suspend Valdez for 5 days without pay. Superintendent Robert Runcie said the district does not condone that type of behavior.
I take the situation very seriously. Any situation involving wrongful treatment of our students is something that we absolutely don't tolerate.
Your questions are welcome for the panel. You can call us at 1-800-743-WLRN. That's 1-800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN. And we have our live blog where you can join us online for a discussion on our website, WLRN.org.
And let me bring in the guest for this segment. Joining us now, Nadej Green, WLRN reporter, who's been following the story. Nadej, great to have you.
Thank you, Lewis.
Also joining us, John O'Connor, WLRN education reporter. John, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Rosemary O'Hara, who is the editorial page editor for the Sun Sentinel. Rosemary, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
All right, so Maria Valdez was suspended for 5 days without pay. John, how did the school district come up with that punishment?
Well, it's based on their contract with the union that, you know, in certain discipline cases, they kind of have a checklist to follow. And going through her record, they came up with this punishment that it fit the accusations here.
All right. Is there a precedent, I'm wondering, for this? Is there a specific rule on how teachers must comport themselves? And if they don't, this is the punishment? And is there just something in the books that tells you that?
Yeah, it's all laid out in the contract that, you know, these types of things would be considered personnel issues. You could be, you know, could be reprimanded for this type of behavior. So, I mean, it's pretty clearly spelled out for most teachers what is and what isn't professional behavior.
And Nadej, what's the policy on bullying? And John as well, you can jump in. But I mean, if you have a student bullying another student, okay, we understand what that is. But what about a teacher bullying a student? What do we know? Is there any rule on that?
Absolutely. And that is the point that Youssef Wardani, who is Diab Hussein Wardani's father, made, that this was bullying. I mean, the teacher faced four administrative charges in this case that the school board found were sustained, which were incompetency, immorality. One was a violation of a school board policy that says, in part, teachers should infuse in their classrooms respect, honesty, and kindness, which would all fall under that.
And also part of the punishment is that Maria Valdez has to undergo diversity training. So what does that entail? Who submits this training? What do we know about this training? John?
You know, I don't know a whole lot about the training. I'm curious to find out. I think that's definitely something that is one of the follow-up stories to this is, okay, now what? What happens with the school district? What happens with the teacher? And how do we make sure that this doesn't happen again?
Rosemary, I mean, is that typical, a diversity training? We hear about people who have to go through anger management training, but is that just normal?
Well, I'm not that familiar with the policies of the school system. I know that another teacher in the past has used slur and had the same kind of punishment. But I don't blame the father for being outraged, or the family, or the community for being outraged that this teacher, not just one time, she did it over the course of a week. She was using language that was slurs and showed poor behavior. So now she's going to have a week suspension, and she's going to have diversity training. 5 days, I guess, of diversity training.
And a lot of people are not happy with that. They think 5 days is nothing. They're asking for a lot more. What are they asking for?
Well, you know, I know that the boy wanted an apology. Whatever the interaction was between the teacher and the family was insufficient. And, you know, for somebody who shows such behavior, to say, well, we're going to send that person to diversity training, and that, as though that's going to fix it, without telling the rest of us, how do we know that this is, that this is going to do the trick? Is there some kind of supervision? Is there some kind of an apology? I thought the superintendent's remarks were well, right on point in not wanting to, you know, in not tolerating this behavior. But it goes to union contracts that, you know, the school board's hands are tied for how they can handle discipline.
And Nadej, real quickly, the father, I think, even said wants to approach the FBI, or did?
He approached the FBI. I mean, his point was that this was hate speech, and this was racism, and he says that, you know, it's not okay. So he reported it to FBI. He's reported it to the police. They told him this isn't classified as a hate crime, but for him, it is. And he says he's not going to let this die, that this is not okay for a teacher to be able to call his son an ethnic slur.
All right, John?
Yeah, and another one of his concerns, Lewis, is that there may be something systematic here, that similar complaints like this may have been filed in the past, and that parents who got the same reaction he felt he got from the school district, which was to essentially, you know, he felt ignored, that they didn't take his complaint seriously, that they didn't call him back, that they didn't follow up with him. And so his concern is, what if this is a systematic problem? What if parents are reporting this kind of stuff all the time? And so he's looking, you know, he's interested in finding out whether that's the case or not.
An important point to make, Lewis, is that he felt that there was a teaching moment here that was lost. He said the teacher uttered this in a classroom full of kids, and that an apology wasn't just enough. They could have brought in, you know, someone who is Muslim to talk to the class, what it means to be Muslim, to go past stereotypes, to go past these things and teach the kids not only that the teacher was wrong in saying this, but here is our experience as Muslim Americans.
There was a teachable moment, all right, and they should have dismissed this teacher permanently and sent a message of zero tolerance for this kind of language. And because the school system's hands are tied by the contract, it's part of the reason why more parents are putting their kids in charter schools and private schools.
Yeah, you know, and I think we're all wondering how it's okay for someone to say that. You know, you wonder, was she joking around? You know, where did this come from? And one of the comments that the father made was, I promise you for the rest of my life until my dying breath, I'm going to make sure no child goes through what my Diab Hussein had to go through. He said that after the meeting. So, you know, what does that mean? Does this suggest a lawsuit is coming?
There isn't a lawsuit specifically coming, or if there is one coming, it's definitely not about money, he says. He wants there to be stiffer penalties for teachers who say these words, not just to Muslim students, but whatever race, whatever religion, whatever sexual orientation a kid might be. They should not have to go to school and feel hatred from their teachers. They should feel protected when they go to school, especially with their teachers.
Something too, by the way, and Rosemary brought this up, but it's the fact that it wasn't a one-time comment. This teacher had said a number of things toward this student. And I'm wondering, you know, the student, from my understanding, did not know what was being said toward him, did not realize it was an insult immediately, but other students were laughing?
Well, no, I spoke with DH at his home with his father, and he did know it was something negative. He just was not clear what the definition of the Taliban was, but it was clear to him that he was being picked on. And he went home and he asked his dad specifically, who is from Lebanon, what does the Taliban mean? And that kind of shook his parents. They were like, well, why do you want to know? And that's when he said, well, my teacher called me that.
Again, if you want to share your comments on this, the number is 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us. Again, the call sign at WLRN. And let's go to the phones. Let's go to Travis in Coral Springs. Travis, welcome to the program. Do we have Travis there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Travis.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. Sorry about that. I just want to say, as an educator here in the system in Broward County, I feel as though the school board sort of reached on this. I agree that the teacher should have been reprimanded. However, with the school board taking such a strong stance on such an issue that has to do with a tolerance, I'm just not sure where they will be going when other issues come up that deal with incompetent teachers. Will they make the same type of statement? So those are my comments, and I'll listen off the air.
All right. Thank you very much, Travis. Appreciate that. What else have we learned from what the school board – what is the school board taking from this? I'm wondering, is it – they got a little bit defensive, Nadege? Maybe perhaps they should have not said anything, or is this the right thing to do?
I think Superintendent Runcie was very clear in his message was that this is not acceptable for him personally or as a school board, and that they absolutely will discipline teachers when this happens. I think the question is, when it comes to parents and people who see this, like, is this enough or is this too much? In some cases, there are some people who feel that the teacher shouldn't have been suspended, while there's a large group of folks who are online and they're commenting on this saying she should have just been plain outright fired.
All right, let's go back to the phones. I want to go to Pablo, who is calling in from Miami. Pablo, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you guys doing today?
All right, Pablo, what's your take on this?
Well, you know what? As a teacher in Miami for over 20 years and a union member, I kind of see both sides to this. The comment was inappropriate, and the teacher probably should have been reprimanded. But I do believe that, at least in the existing agreement that Broward County Schools has with the BTU, you know, under collective bargaining, this is the price that teacher has to pay. I know someone said that the community might say it's only 5 days, but it's 5 days, I believe, without pay, which for somebody with as many years as I believe the teacher in question, that's a lot of money. And also, the public needs to understand that these things are hashed out in collective bargaining through the process. If Broward County wants to change or agree to some changes in how they punish teachers, is something that needs to be worked out in the collective bargaining process. We're lucky in South Florida, as public educators and public employees, that we have at least some semblance of union protection left, whereas other parts of the state and the country are losing that. So this is kind of a thing where it's a wrong. Definitely someone was wronged. The teacher was punished. So maybe some things need to be changed later, but this is an issue where anti-union people could take it and just run with it.
All right. So
and
the
I think that's a fine line.
The union contract is protecting teachers, is what you're saying. All right, Pablo, thank you so much. John?
I think Pablo brings up a really interesting kind of thing going on, a dynamic going on with this debate, because when you're dealing with a bureaucracy, when you're dealing with something like a school district, that process is very, very important to them. They know what the law says. They know what their obligations are legally according to that contract. Where that kind of falls down is with the dad, because when the dad reported this to the school district, all he wanted back from the school district was a call to say, we've got your complaint, we're working on it. He felt like he didn't get that. And I think in part that felt like that was because, you know, the school district was saying, all right, we're going to run through the process now. We're not going to get in contact with the dad until we've done all of our due diligence on this. And so he said, look, give me a call back. He never got a call back. And that's when he went to the media. And so that's, you know, there's this misunderstanding or disconnect between the public and a school district sometimes because of all these obligations within the contract.
And I would like to hear from the union, frankly. You know, here the kid was wearing a hoodie. We saw what happened to Trayvon Martin, you know, because of the hoodie incident. The remark was used more than once. If this is the contract, you can understand that it has to be upheld. But tell us, union, and how is this protecting our kids? And is this okay with you? Or say, tell us, you know, okay, we're going to make sure we don't condone this. We're dealing with it properly. We're going to ensure that she gets the training she needs. And, you know, we're going to follow up because this is not okay with us either.
All right. And you're talking about the union. Let's go back to the phones. We'll go to Jeff in Plantation asking about rules in place for the union, from the union, and discipline on teachers. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me. That was the question I was going to ask as well. I understand that there are categories of infractions that might warrant certain punishments, but is there any leeway the union has that where they can step up and say, we understand this falls under this category and the school board has to do this, but now we can do something as well? Can the union waive any prearranged rules or institute any punishment themselves on a teacher who does something like this?
John?
No, generally unions don't do that. You know, they this is why they fight for these things, so that they're written into the contract, so that everybody knows what the process is. Everybody knows if this is the infraction, then this is the punishment, and so that there's no guessing or, you know, kind of ad hoc decision making.
By the way, does this child have to stay in this class with this teacher?
The school board did give them an option. The school did give him an option. If he wanted to, he could pull his son out of the class. But Youssef Wardini said, why should my son have to leave his class with his friends that he's comfortable in? The teacher should have to leave. She did something wrong.
But so he may be in the same class with the teacher. This is
he is in the same class with the teacher, and he calls it awkward, but he's in the class. And he says his classmates support him, and they, you know, his classmates, he says, understand that the teacher did something wrong. So it's not awkward from the perspective of his classmates. It's just awkward that he's in the class with this teacher who called him this slur.
You know what? I also wanted to ask, I guess, the bigger picture, kind of backing up a little bit and just looking at this issue of racism in schools. I think it's fair to say that, yeah, we're going to deal with racism everywhere we go, but is this something that happens normally? Do we have problems with teachers making comments towards students? Not just students towards students, but teachers towards students. We're a very diverse region down here.
I mean, we know anecdotally that there are people who have complained. I mean, on Twitter, we've seen comments of other Muslim students who have said that, oh, this happened to me too, but I never said anything about it. So I think there might be a case of underreporting. When these things do happen, students might not feel comfortable enough to report it. This is their teacher, someone in a position of power, or that parents don't understand the process, or when they do go through the process, if they feel that, you know, they didn't get a proper response from whoever was at the front office, they don't push it.
Gina Jordan?
You know, I'm just wondering, I don't know anything about, you know, Maria Valdez. I don't know how long she's been teaching. And like you said, apparently this is not necessarily an isolated incident. And I'm just wondering, has she said anything? I haven't even seen a picture of her. I'm just wondering if we know anything at all about her.
I mean, her record is clear, according to the school board, that this is like the first infraction on her record. But she has not commented. I've reached out to her for comments. She's not commented to me or any other media source that I'm aware of.
All right, again, the number is 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Again, you can also just post your comments or questions at WLRN. Find us on Twitter at WLRN. Let's go back to the phones, and let's go to Joey in Miami. Joey, welcome to the program.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me. Well, I just want to say I'm a psychology student at Lynn University, and I've studied this psychological profile called the need for closure, and it's characterized by a preference for familiarity and an intolerance for ambiguity, and I think that sounds like what is going on here, and I don't personally think that 5 days of suspension without pay sends a message that intolerance is not tolerated.
All right, so the 5 days, this goes back to what some people are saying. 5 days is not enough. It's not going to perhaps tell other teachers this isn't acceptable. But Rosemary, are other teachers talking about this, discussing the punishment and whether or not they felt that their peer got a fair punishment or not?
I have to imagine that when something has gotten news, not just locally but around the world, that people are talking about it. And hopefully a message is sent that this is not acceptable. And most of our teachers are professional and know how to handle kids. But I think I'm offended that she is still in this classroom teaching a child who she has expressed these sentiments about.
All right, I want to go back to the phones. I want to hear from Enrique in Miami. Enrique, welcome to the program.
Yes. Hi. How are you doing?
Go ahead, Enrique. What are your thoughts on this?
I think that it's being blown out of proportion a little bit. We don't exactly know in what context this teacher was making that statement. And although I agree it's inappropriate, I think that what they're doing is they're trying to make a political point union-wise, using this comment from this teacher as an example. That's what I'm taking from what I'm listening to your program. I might be wrong, but I think that it's being blown out of proportion.
All right. So Enrique's saying it's being blown out of proportion.
Well, for the father, it really doesn't matter what context you call his son this slur. I mean, she called him Raghead Taliban. She called him Taliban. When she would call on him, she would call him terrorista, terrorist in Spanish. So for his father, regardless of whether she thought she was joking, this is not a joke. This isn't funny.
And again, John, did we hear anything about there were any other complaints on this particular teacher?
No, there weren't, as far as we know. And I think a key point about whether this is being blown out of proportion is all the father wanted was an apology initially. You know, he wasn't really looking to punish this teacher. He wanted an apology. I think he would have liked the teacher to have been removed from that particular class so that his son wouldn't have been in the classroom. But all of this stuff happened because he felt like he didn't get a response from the school district, from law enforcement, from every avenue that he literally tried every avenue. I mean, he's emailed just about everybody at the White House about this. And he felt like he got no response. And so that's why this thing has escalated, because he said, well, if it happened to me, then who else is it happening to?
All right. Again, the number is 800-743-WLRN. Let's go to Joe in Oakland Park. Joe, you think this sends the wrong message? The discipline sends the wrong message.
Yeah, I do. I think it's part of our culture of action and reaction, and it doesn't teach anything about how to reconcile and about how learning to understand each other and appreciate each other. I think it should be a more creative response to it. I think the kids should stay in the classroom with that teacher, and they need to learn about each other. Maybe she ought to spend time at his family's home. Because I think it sends the wrong message. We're so quick to run to attorneys and make everything so difficult, and I think it should be a different reaction.
All right, but again, we haven't heard that there would be a lawsuit. We did hear the father, again, would probably approach, or has approached, excuse me, the FBI. You know what? I want to go over to Andrew in Boca Raton. Andrew, are you a teacher?
Yes, hi. I'm a former public school teacher, current college professor. First, I want to thank everyone at NPR. You provide such a valuable service to our community by having such meaningful discussions such as this one. I would ask everyone to consider the credibility of the teacher going forward. How does a teacher administer discipline going forward after an incident like this? I think the teacher's credibility would be eliminated at this point. It also, we regularly send this message to students not to bully, and yet this sends a message that teachers are allowed to. In comparison, if you take a look at for comparative purposes,
Let me stop you there, Raku, because you have 2 points, and I want to finish up with this last point. You make a good one there. Thank you so much for the call. But let's just finish with this one and talking about what does happen next, especially with this teacher and how this teacher approaches her class, especially this student, Nadesh.
Well, I think we should also be clear that this is what the board voted on, this 5-day suspension and mandatory diversity training. But she can appeal this per union rules. And so this is not yet closed, because if she does choose to appeal this, her punishment could change depending on, you know, what the outcome of that appeals process is.
And Rosemary, again, hearing some parents saying that they want harsher punishment, even possibly expulsion of the teacher. Do you think there's any legs in that? Or do you think it goes forward?
Oh, I think that the punishment that she's getting is the official punishment she's getting is what the board voted for. Whether there are after effects and whether we hear more from her, it's really the ball's in her court to let us know that this diversity training worked, that she got the message, that she's going to be a good teacher and respect her students. So hers is the voice that I really want to hear from now.
Rosemary O'Hara is the editorial page editor for the Sun Sentinel. We also heard from John O'Connor, WLRN education reporter, and Nadesh Green, WLRN reporter who has been following the story. Guys, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, still ahead, the so-called bathroom bill passes its second House committee in Tallahassee. We'll have more on that and what's going on in the legislature coming up next on the Florida Roundup.
I'm Gina Jordan with Luis Hernandez. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. We are joined by Gary Fineout, Associated Press reporter in Tallahassee, and still with us, Rosemary O'Hara, editorial page editor for the Sun Sentinel. This week, the so-called bathroom bill that would make it illegal for transgender people to enter public facilities that don't match the gender of their birth like bathrooms or locker rooms, passed a second committee in the Florida House. The vote was 7-4. The bill makes it a second-degree misdemeanor to knowingly and willfully enter those public facilities. Penalties can reach up to 60 days in jail and a $500 fine. Representative Frank Artillis, a Miami Republican and the bill's sponsor, says this bill is intended to address a Miami-Dade County ordinance that protects the rights of transgender people. He calls it overbroad and subjective. He also says that while 10 Florida counties have passed such protections, the language varies.
I want something that's fair, something that can be used across the board, and something that's uniform throughout the state. Because again, I'm sensitive to everybody's issue, but at the end of the day, we have to balance people's feelings and our cultural differences and quite frankly, our backgrounds.
Dozens of speakers have testified before lawmakers saying the bill would expose transgender people to more violence than they already face. Brenda Massarella is transgender and a military veteran.
I fought for my country and I bled for my country. Today I'm fighting another battle, a battle about using what bathroom I'm supposed to use. Only this time there's not being bullets thrown at me. It's being accusations that I am a pervert. I am all kinds of things, which I am not.
Your questions are welcome for the panel. You can call in 1-800-743-WLRN. That's 1-800-743-9576. Tweet us at WLRN.
So, Gary, the House bill now has, I think, 7 co-sponsors. Lawmakers heard testimony that transgender people are not a threat in bathrooms, that they're the ones who often are victims of crimes. So what do you think this bill is really trying to accomplish?
Well, I think obviously the bill was born out of the situation in Miami-Dade. And I think that the Representative Artilla has been very, you know, strong in his belief that the Miami-Dade ordinance, quote, has loopholes and that it's not clear and that he wants to, you know. And this is a common tactic in Florida where if there's something that happens in one particular county or something like that, there's a move to go up to Tallahassee and just have a law that takes care of it statewide. Preemption happens all the time on a lot of different issues. Of course, this one is much more personal for a lot of people.
And I'm wondering, how will this law be enforced if it's passed? You know, how do we prove that someone's in the wrong bathroom?
That's an excellent question. I've read the bill, and I'm not quite sure exactly how the enforcement of this is going to happen. There is some. If you've read the bill yourself, you notice that there's some language about civil liability. So it looks like beyond being able to complain to somebody, it also looks like that people theoretically could file a lawsuit and say that they were traumatized to some extent by the fact that a person of the opposite gender was in the bathroom.
This bill has another House committee to go, and then it'll go to the full chamber. And we know that oftentimes these things are negotiated behind the scenes, even though they're not supposed to be, which brings us to Government in the Sunshine Week. This is a time that media outlets and lots of folks like to highlight the importance of open government and freedom of information. And a great example of this is the recent ousting of Florida Department of Law Enforcement Commissioner Gerald Bailey. Government leaders made some decisions privately that should have been discussed in public. And in fact, there's now a big lawsuit over this. A lot of media groups say the governor and members of the Florida cabinet violated the Sunshine Law in this case, and they want an independent investigation. Rosemary, you're on the board of the First Amendment Foundation, which tracks these things. You know, the foundation says more than 1,100 exemptions to the Sunshine Law are on the books in Florida, and now lawmakers are considering more ways to close off open government. What can you tell us about some of the current proposals?
Well, Florida's Sunshine Law is considered the nation's best for giving people access to government, both to records and to public meetings. But what we've learned in the last week, you've heard a lot about government in the sunshine because Florida news organizations came together and did audits of state agencies and local agencies to see how people are responding to the public's rights to know. And what we're finding, both in the lawsuit that you're referencing right now, but on a bigger sense, is that your right to know is increasingly facing more barriers. It's taking longer, more delays to get the information you want. the kinds of fees that government is charging in order to get records. There was a case in Broward County. The South Florida Gay News wanted to have the Broward Sheriff's Office do a review of the emails of deputies for a five-month period. Just can you tell us if these slur words were used in any emails by Broward Sheriff's Office? They were told it would take 4 years and $399,000 to get this information. It's supposed to be that with technology, information should be easier to get. And what has happened is that there are so many exemptions, and another close to 50 that are being considered this year are making it more difficult and more costly, and people are hiding. I mean, we saw the governor who said he didn't do business, public business on his personal email, and only after he won election did his lawyers release a couple hundred pages worth of emails. We saw, as you mentioned, the Sunshine Law being avoided by end-arounds by the cabinet staff to ouster the head of the FDLE. We see it with the Department of Corrections and the issues with the prisons and these corrections folks being told to sign confidentiality agreements or they'll lose their jobs. We see it with DCF, you know, that's no longer putting online what is causing the death of these kids. And so the message that I think media organizations want your listeners to know this week is that our politicians talk about transparency when they are running for office, but once they go to Tallahassee, something happens. It's like they hunker down and they think if you ask them a question, you must be out to get them, and they don't want you to know. And it is you know, a red flag, everybody, that something is happening here, and it matters, because the only way in a democracy you can hold your government accountable is if you know what's going on, and they're making it a lot more difficult to find out what's going on.
Yeah, Gary, I want to ask you, you know, Governor Scott came into office 4 years ago seeming to not understand that he can't keep the business of the state private. He needs to make it public. And have we seen any changes?
Well, I think what we've seen is that it's just been increasingly difficult at times to get a lot of information. Rosemary mentioned the emails. I was the one who asked for those emails, and it was months before the request was responded to. I routinely, you put in requests, and you just don't know when you're going to get the information back. And it's just not in a timely fashion. And, you know, frankly, short of suing the government agencies on a constant basis, which is just not practical. I mean, it's just that they continually drag their feet in a lot of instances before they give you this stuff. In terms of Governor Scott, what's interesting is, if you recall, they accidentally deleted the transition emails, and we went through a whole process there trying to see if we could recover those. That was from the beginning. And, you know, the situation is that, you know, Governor Scott did use email all the time when he was on the campaign trail, because I saw him. And so clearly there was a decision made to try to come up with ways to sort of, I don't want to say it's deliberate, but there was clearly a conscious effort when Scott came into office to find ways to sort of not make it easy for people to figure out what they were communicating about.
And just this week, the governor's office said that he no longer uses email. Now, why is that? Why? It obviously seems to be that he doesn't want to leave a trail of the work he's doing on behalf of the public. What other reason would explain why the governor will no longer use email?
Well, to be fair, I would like to point out is that he really stopped using email when he came into office in 2011. There were I would routinely get requests even back in 2011, and there would only be a handful of times even then that he would ever really respond. And then, of course, that's why the fact that there were 200 pages on the other account was a bit illuminating, because it did show that there was some level of communication going on at the time. So he kind of went from where he was hardly doing it at all in the public arena to not at all.
Thank you, Gary Fineout with the Associated Press in Tallahassee, and Rosemary O'Hara, editorial page editor for The Sun Sentinel. Finally on the roundup, what did South Florida sound like this week? WLRN's John O'Connor has this audio postcard to send us into the weekend.
It's Friday, and this is what South Florida sounded like this week.
Okay, you're late. Down on the one.
What is Miami Gardens' brand? What is the message that they want people to take away?
I don't just want to be any politician, I want to be president. And the very first, transgender president.
Failure to think about how climate change might impact global interrelated systems, all elements of U.S. national power and national security, is a failure of imagination that we can't afford to let happen.
Today, it is your job to conquer and not be conquered.
You want to just do that first entrance, or how do you feel?
I'm afraid as soon as I get to the highway, I'm going to get into a car crash.
Oh, hold up. Wait. Let's get the sound of this.
What do Penn and Teller call it? Oh, yes. Bullshit.
To hear more, go to WLRN.org/this week.
And you can hear our Week in Sound every Friday afternoon. Just go to WLRN.org/this week and follow us on SoundCloud.
That's the Florida Roundup for Friday, March 20th. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen to it again on these airwaves tomorrow morning at 6 a.m., and we'll post it on our website at WLRN.org.
The Florida Roundup is produced by Alicia Zuckerman and Julia Dubo. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Our digital editor is Maria Muriel. Our executive producer for WLRN is Peter J. Mars. Our technical supervisor, Paul Leary. South Florida Arts Beat is next. I'm Luis Hernandez.
And I'm Gina Jordan. Thanks for listening.